Welcome to the Center of Everywhere podcast, where we explore stories of rural Minnesotans who are making a difference in their communities. Rural isn't in the middle of nowhere. It is in the center of everywhere.
Hello, and welcome to episode 2 of season 2 for the Center of Everywhere podcast. Grocery stores have been on Julie's mind lately. As a member of the Waseca EDA, she finds herself thinking about ways and alternatives to attract a new grocery store business to the community to help fill a need that is currently only filled by Walmart. On this episode, she discusses one alternative, food cooperatives. She's joined by three experts and leaders who are thoroughly active in their own local grocery cooperatives. They discuss their own stories and how they got involved in local foods, the challenges, opportunities, and resources available to build such a business, and how current distribution infrastructure of foods works a bit against these organizations due to lower volume.
Hello, and welcome to the Center of Everywhere podcast, where we explore issues important to rural Minnesota. My name is Julie Tesh, and I am the president and CEO of the Center for Rural Policy and Development. Today on our show, we are following up on our season 1, episode 18 podcast, where we talked about rural grocery stores and the rise of dollar stores. A bright light in the struggle of rural grocery stores are food co-ops across rural Minnesota. These co-ops aren't owned by a family, individual, or corporation, but they are owned by the shoppers themselves in the community. Food co-ops started in Minnesota in the early 1970s and have played an important role in providing safe, affordable, and nutritious food. Joining us today are three experts in the area of rural food co-ops. Jeannie Wells is an organizational development consultant and retail grocery specialist. She does development work through Columinate, a cooperative of 50 consultants who work together to bring local impact to communities through their support with cooperatives, nonprofits, and mission-driven independent businesses. Next is Ryan Pesch. He is the owner and operator of Lita Farm, a diversified and organic vegetable operation in Otter Tail County near Pelican Rapids. He and his wife market primarily vegetables via CSA, the Lakes Area Farmers Market in Detroit Lakes, a self-serve stand, and through other retailers. In his professional life, Ryan serves as an extension educator with the University of Minnesota, where he works with communities and business organizations on issues of economic development, tourism, and business development. And third, we have Jennifer Jaco DeVries. She is a writer, fundraiser, organizer, and advocate located in Brainerd. She is a consultant and helps nonprofit organizations increase their fundraising and outreach. Jennifer is also a member of the Crow Wing County Food Co-op, one of the oldest and longest running food cooperatives in Minnesota that started in 1979. So welcome everyone to the Center of Everywhere. Glad you guys are all here. We're just going to dive right in because we have so much to talk about. I feel like we could do several episodes with all of you on here, but let's start with this one. Let's just get back to basics with cooperatives. People may not realize that the cooperative movement was developed in the upper Midwest and that Minnesota has been a trendsetter in that regard. And so, Jeannie, could you give our listeners a 20,000-foot view of what the cooperative model and how it can help rural communities?
Sure. Well, you described it a little bit in your intro. A cooperative is a group of people that come together to, in this case, own something. And I think here in the Midwest, a lot of people in rural communities are familiar with producer co-ops. Those are organizations that are owned by the farmers or the producers themselves. When we're talking about food co-ops, we're usually talking about consumer co-ops, which is a little bit different, but it just means it's owned by the shoppers. And unlike dollar stores or large chains, it's like hyper-local organized ownership so that all of the benefits from the organization are designed explicitly to serve the owners in the local community. So it's an ownership model, but it's really designed to steer those profits and those resources right back to the community where those member owners are from. The other thing that I think is just really kind of unique in co-ops. They're all governed by international cooperative principles, but one of them is this one member, one vote. And what that really means is in a community, if you were a publicly traded organization, if there was a very wealthy owner who owned a lot of share, they would have considerable more say in the organization. Whereas in food co-ops, it's one member, one vote. It actually doesn't matter if there's one person with a whole lot of money, they really only get one vote. They don't get to decide things on behalf of the group any more than anybody else. And I think that's especially important in rural communities where it really levels the playing field of, you know, we all have an equal say in the direction that we want this organization to go. So that's my 30,000 foot view.
That's fantastic. And while we're talking 30,000 foot views, let's follow that up with some small grocery business 101 and the core issues that we're looking at in those small rural grocery stores and how that community support makes it all possible.
Yeah, I mean, and I think on some of your earlier episodes, you talk about this, but, you know, the grocery business truly is usually a volume driven business. The sort of the trends of the last, you know, 70 years, 50 years, especially 20 years, it's really about increased volume really brings lower prices. And what that means for small rural groceries, whether they're mom and pop groceries or cooperatives, is it's not a very level playing field. It really is a little bit rigged against them. The warehouses often have minimum orders that a grocery store has to hit in order to get a delivery. And so the smaller you are, the fewer deliveries you get because you can't hit the minimum orders. So, you know, small stores are always kind of working against the system, trying to make sure they're bringing food to their communities. In the end, it's a very low profit business. It's, you know, after you pay for your goods and after you pay for your labor, which as small businesses usually give a much larger percentage of their sales to their workers than a corporation does. And then after you pay rent and insurance and all of that, I mean, at best, you're usually getting 1% net profit. And so, you know, if something happens, I mean, it just doesn't take a lot to really take away that one penny out of every dollar that these small grocery stores are trying to operate under. So, you know, mom and pop stores and food cooperatives the same. I mean, these are sort of the lifeblood groceries of these small communities around, I mean, the Midwest and all over the country, really.
You know, I like how you put that. I like how you put that with for every dollar, like one penny. That's right. Their profit. I think that's something that people can easily visualize. So when they're shopping at a food co-op or at their mom and pop grocery store, thinking that, oh, I just spent $5 on X, they will actually only make 5 cents.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's so little. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So profound. Go ahead.
I was going to say, I think, you know, when I used to be a general manager, that's usually how I would train the staff is we had a, you know, we'd usually say, where does the dollar go? And we're like, for every dollar we sell, here's how much we gave to the warehouse or the small farmer. Here's how much we're paying you. Here's how much our credit card fees are. Here's that, you know, and in the end, it's one penny. It's not a lot to play with, really. And then out of that, have to, you know, buy new shopping carts and replace a freezer and repave the parking lot and, you know, all of that. That's where the higher volume and the larger stores, they have such an advantage because those pennies add up so much faster, you know.
Yeah, that's a lot of pennies. And what drove you to become interested in, you know, you're a general manager at a food co-op. What piqued your interest?
Well, it was a funny turn. I actually wanted to be a market gardener. I wanted to learn about local food systems, and my food co-op was hiring a part-time position in the produce department 2 nights a week. And I thought, well, this will be perfect. I'll do this just a little part-time job and I'll learn about the local food system. I don't know what, as it happens, just, you know, pretty soon I was full-time in produce and then I was finance manager because I'd worked in an accounting office. And then our general manager left, actually to come start the Eastside Food Co-op up there in the cities. And I kind of was left, you know, they asked if I would do it and I reluctantly applied and became the general manager and stayed and grew that co-op. I was there for 14 years and we, you know, started out, I think we were at like 3 million a year when I started. And when I left, we were 13 and a half million or something. So we learned a lot. I learned a lot about local food systems. So I did get my wish.
Oh my goodness. We're so fortunate to have you on today. That's fantastic. That's fantastic. So this is like a great lead in to Jennifer and Ryan. Jennifer, you are on the board of the Crow Wing County Food Cooperative, and that's one of the oldest and the longest running food cooperatives in Minnesota. And Ryan, you're on the board of Manna out of Detroit Lakes, which is a newer food cooperative. So I guess I'm going to ask you, Jennifer, first, what got you involved at first? Why don't you tell us about the Crow Wing County Cooperative? And it sounds like you started, you know, we were talking earlier, started small and you just recently expanded. So why don't you tell us about that?
Yeah. So like you said previously, we were founded in 1979 and Jeannie sort of touched on this too, but, you know, families come together to create better access, more affordable access to healthy and local foods. And, you know, the 70s, I was a baby then, but as I understand it, the 70s were kind of a funny period where these new foods were coming about and like white flour were sort of the dominant thing. And so it was a little bit more difficult in communities like Brainerd to find healthier foods like whole wheat flour and so forth. So families came together to create better access. And at first it was a buying club. As I understand it, people would gather in somebody's home and divide up the bulk foods. And then they moved into a storefront eventually once they had enough members and enough funds to do so. And they were in that storefront for several decades. And in 2010 moved into our previous store, which was 900 square feet. And when I moved to Brainerd in 2016, I joined immediately. We had become interested in food systems and local food systems and previously joined Eastside Food Co-op, which Jeannie had mentioned in Minneapolis. That was our first co-op. So we joined Crow Wing Food Co-op immediately. We moved to Brainerd. And then I joined the board in 2018. And by then they'd been in that storefront for about 8 years and had pretty quickly grown out of it. There was minimal storage and just a desire to have more diverse products and more quantities. So when I joined the board in 2018, we began to sort of hypothesize and think about how we could grow and what we would want to add if we could grow. And so in 2019, we were very fortunate to be positioned to participate in a contest that was hosted by our local Chamber of Commerce, which was aimed at bringing more businesses downtown Brainerd into the historic downtown square. In this contest, an existing business could apply, so could participate. So we did that and we ended up winning that contest, which was great. We were able to mobilize our many members and get people excited about local food and had this tremendous platform to talk about the power of local food and how, you know, here's the business Chamber of Commerce. Let me talk to you about local farmers who are also business people who may not have the resources to be members and on that platform. So we got to talk about the power of local food systems and the power of your food dollars, how we all spend so many hundreds of dollars every month feeding our family. How powerful is that if we can move those monies to local farmers and to this small storefront where we're really trying to create good jobs and bring in good, healthy foods and talk about nutrition and talk about whole foods with our members. And, you know, so we were able to really communicate on a broader platform and I think invite more people in. I think our membership has grown pretty substantially. And now we've got a space with about 4,000 square feet and we've got a deli and a smoothie bar. And we're really trying to bring in those local foods for daily specials and help people just understand who the local farmers are. We have so many great farmers in our area, and we're able to showcase them a little better and, you know, bring better food into our community.
So over the years, you guys have just grown and learned and grown some more. I mean, you're the Crow Wing County Co-op sounds like the St. Peter Co-op. That's the one that I try to frequent, and they have the deli, and yeah, I love that place. So that's really awesome. I'm assuming that the members and also the residents of the community have been happy with your expansion.
I think so. I mean, I will say also that we, you know, we're about 6 months in, 7 months into this store, and we still feel like we've got a lot to learn and a lot we want to do still. I think there's a lot more growth potential for the deli in that area. And, but yeah, I think people are excited about it. It's, they're doing really beautiful daily specials, and I think people are enjoying that. It's nice to have a healthier option when you're looking for a quick lunch and you're at work and you can go over to the food co-op and, you know, grab something easy.
Yeah, absolutely.
And healthy.
So Ryan, in your work with Manna Food Co-op in Detroit Lakes, why, I know that's a newer food co-op. Why don't you tell me about Manna and how you got involved? And then also from your point of view as being a producer of vegetables, how you are involved in that way as well.
Oh no, since we're all telling kind of our conversion stories, if you will, mentioned St. Peter. You know, I was a Gusty grad, or I am a Gusty grad. So back in the 90s, that's what turned me on to the whole food movement, if you will. I didn't like grow up farming or anything like that. I grew up a town kid in East Grand Forks. But I remember, like, as an undergrad, I went into the St. Peter Food Court, which was much smaller at the time. And I think the thing that impressed me was that here's an organization, a group of people that are trying to make some shift or change on Main Street, right? It's a business, but there's this greater kind of mission at play, you know, and like any good co-op, I mean, I didn't grow up with co-op, so I went in and has a certain smell, right? The people that work there, just a little more friendly than your usual grocery workers. There's this deli over here where people are just leisurely having lunch. I mean, there's, it just, to me, it struck me as this thing where it's like, you're trying to build wealth in the community, you're trying to build community, and you're trying to get that access and sort of raise the consciousness of this whole wellness thing, like Jennifer is talking about. How to, you know, and so I don't know, that just got me into the whole food movement, if you will. And so I've been kind of passionate about co-ops ever since, and led me to apprentice on a farm for about 20 years now. I've been an organic vegetable operator. Did 2 year stint as an apprentice. I worked 4 years at Mississippi Market in the meantime. I was in the produce department. I worked grocery at the old Randolph store. And so for us and Manna, when that the opportunity came about, I'm sitting there at the farmer's market in Detroit Lakes. I was there for 14 years. And one local resident who's just like, she's like this food service director who's like super excited about everything, really is like, I'm initiating a co-op in town. I'm like, well, sign me up. And so, you know, for me, it's just sort of always been a passion of mine. It's just, I feel like co-ops are those kind of really authentic Main Street businesses that people can plug into for a number of different reasons, if you will. It isn't simply about, the high quality brown rice is good. Some people come for health, some people come for community, some people come because they just want to make a change and support an independent business on their Main Street. And so I'm the last original board member to Manna. We incorporated in 2015 and opened doors in 2017. So, and then just recently, just like Crow Wing Co-op, we moved in the new years from what I call the abandoned Tasty Freeze on the north side of town to a pretty nice storefront right downtown, which kind of has a lot more visibility and captures a lot more people, or captures their attention. We're not capturing people.
Oh gosh, I hope not. Jeez. that's the backside, right, of the business, right? I'm curious, how many members do you have, Ryan?
Right now we have, I think, 871 members.
Wow, in 2 years. Wow.
Yep. So when from beginning of 2016 till when we opened in August of 2017, I know we're a little under where Stuart Reed wanted us to be, Jeannie, in terms of consulting. You should have about 500 members before you open these doors. So we opened about, I think, 430 members. So we bought our membership now. And kind of like Jennifer, I mean, our first storefront, I mean, we had 1,000 retail square feet and 200 square feet maybe in the back, tiny little office, tiny little deli. And so we just bootstrapped that thing. And then, you know, the community really supported us when we said, look, we need to come to a new location if this thing's going to be a viable business. We really need to take this up a notch. We're away from the central business district. We're just kind of an invisible location. We needed to be a much more visible location. And we also needed more space. So, and then with that, we were that period of short period of time. I think we're now pushing 900 in terms of our membership.
Wow. That's great. That brings me to actually, I hadn't thought about this, but now that I am, I'm sitting here in Waseca and we have a real big grocery store problem. We have Walmart. That is all. We had a Hy-Vee. They left. Cashwise came in for 9 months. They left. We have Walmart. We have Quick Trip, two of them, and two Casey's. That is all we have. Can you tell our listeners, like, if they're in a community like Waseca or in any other town that might be looking for an alternative to a large grocery store, how do you even get started doing a food co-op? And I'll just open that up for anyone who wants to answer.
I'll start just by saying there are materials out there. There's a how to start a food co-op kind of manual that's been updated over the years and had a lot of people contribute to it. You can find that at foodcoopinitiative.coop or I think also fci.coop. It comes up that way too. That's one of the main resources that a lot of people are directed to just because it's free download and at least starts, you know, painting the, you know, here's the contours of what the development process may look like. I also wanted to say that not, even though I think most of us here on the call today came up through the natural foods kind of pathway of food co-ops, there are a growing number of co-ops that are not necessarily natural foods. They're much more conventional stores in rural areas because that's what their community needs. And so, you know, I think for some of those, like there's one in Houston, mm-hmm. Minnesota, that was a conversion where it was a mom and pop store. They wanted to, the people wanted to sell it and nobody wanted to buy it. And that's a common story. And I think a lot of rural communities, that's what's happening is the people who ran it are trying to retire and nobody wants to buy it. And there's instances in Kansas and Minnesota and Iowa and probably all over Montana where the community themselves, they're going to buy it instead of, you know, putting all the risk on just the shoulders of a person or two people. And so I think if there are people listening and they're in a town where they're fearing losing their grocery store, it doesn't have to be natural foods. It can be a conventional store or a mix. That's by far more common now. But I just think, you know, there's that conversion model where the community goes in and buys, takes over the ownership part of it together. That can be a pathway. I think they can start a food co-op like Mana did. There are also examples out there where a larger food co-op might be near a smaller town. And sometimes that's happening out in California. That happened up in Lakelands, I think, did this, where there was like a startup group that was trying to start a co-op. And the larger one that had a much more robust balance sheet said, why don't we partner with you and help you get that store open? And that can also be a really good pathway to bring a store to your town. So you don't always have to do it all on your own. There are different ways to get there, I would say.
Minnesota's, I think we're still, Jeannie can tell me if I'm wrong, I think we're still Minnesota's youngest co-op. starting opening doors in 2017? I don't know, somebody's beaten us since.
I'm not sure.
I think. Okay. But I'll look it up. But as I'll just stick with that. As Minnesota's youngest food co-op, I mean, I think it's just straight up organizing, right? I mean, you know, so two main points. One is you got to lay out a vision and start converting people to the vision, right? Like, as a community, we can do better, you know, or as a community, we really need this. And that takes initiative. It's the same thing whether you're starting a small community center or you're starting a food co-op. It's really the same process by which you need to kind of sell a community writ large on this idea that kind of inspires them enough that they're like, yeah, I want to chip in. I want to help make that happen, right? And that's definitely what happened with us. For us, our co-op grew, for the most part, out of our farmers market is really what it is that happened. Our initiator, Wendy Gordon, said, you know, hey, you guys work so hard at this farmers market. Wouldn't it be great if we could kind of extend your season or give you a different outlet? And, you know, so she really had the farm operators and local foods at the heart of it all, which already had sort of a base of customers, if you will, right? If you're already shopping at this farmers market, you're like, yeah, I know all these people. Yeah, I'm supportive of what they're doing and that kind of stuff. Their heart is already in the idea, right? So you just need to present it to them. And a second point I think is that is what we see, I think, with what we'll call a lot of, I would just call them third wave co-ops, right? A lot of third wave co-ops have grown out of the local food movement. They've grown out of farmers markets. They've grown out of groups of producers. And I know, Julie, you'd mentioned like, you know, the second wave co-ops, and we really shouldn't forget the first wave co-ops, right? All these Scandinavian socialists who opened a bunch of food co-ops in the turn of the century. So that's where I come up with the third wave, if you will. But that's definitely the case with us. We're very much a third wave co-op in that way. A bunch of people that really engage in kind of the more recent, you know, local food movement and the good food movement. And the idea of opening a storefront made sense. And the last thing I would say is that I'm a strong proponent, having gone through been in the trenches as the treasurer of this co-op, that scale matters and small can actually be an advantage in this current environment. One great danger of a startup is one that's too big. And definitely in the world of grocery, you know, if you gave us 10,000 square feet, it sounds like we'd be very successful. I would say that's a recipe for us going out of business very fast because yeah, got to fill 10,000 square feet. Having gone at 1,000 square foot from 1,000 square foot retail store to now we're at like 1,800, 1,700 square feet, that's a good size for us. And I think once you start talking about sort of a vision that's inspiring to people, but also one that's doable, right? In terms of a startup, that's not crazy. Most communities have a vacant Main Street storefront that's about that size. Make a good gift shop would also make a very good place for a co-op to start. And so once you start marrying, you know, kind of this thing that might inspire people together with something that seems fairly reasonable to do, now you're talking. And I don't think it's out of the realm of the possibility of really any size community. If you have a good rump group of 40, 50 people that are committed, you probably can make it happen.
I love it. You've got my wheels spinning. So Jennifer, since you're at one of the oldest and longest running food co-ops, you know, you guys moved during the pandemic. How has that worked? How have you taken your members and transitioned them to a newer space? Did you lose any? Did you gain any? How does that all come into play?
That's a very good question. Yeah, it was enormously challenging to do this project. We had a big construction project that was necessary. Some renovations were needed. So many volunteers and board members and staff came together to help make this happen. It was really sort of the demonstration of what a cooperative is on display right there as that work got done. we may have lost some folks. I think not members, but potentially the folks who would just drive by our previous store. We used to be on a very busy street in Washington Street in Brainerd, and now we're downtown. We're just a few blocks away, and parking is actually easier. I think it's actually more accessible where we are right now. But because we're not on that main street, which was a highway leading in and out of town, I think that maybe there's some folks who don't see us and then just stop in. So, you know, we do hope to get revenues up so we can do more billboards and more advertising in that way to make sure people still know we exist. But by and large, I think we've brought in more people because there's been some publicity around our store and we've had this opportunity to share what a cooperative is and what we're aiming to do. And we've also run some nice membership drives and really encouraged folks to join us and invest in what we're trying to do here. And so we've definitely seen business grow. I'd like to see us continue to grow, of course, but we've seen a lot more people come in and just be curious about it. And to be honest, you know, our old storefront didn't have the best curb appeal. And so I think there are people now who see our store and are more willing to come in and check us out, not quite so intimidated and unsure just based on the exterior of our store. We look a little more inviting at this point in time. So, yeah. So just like others have said, we do a lot of local food and a lot of the natural foods, but really just trying to broaden that appeal and help people understand the benefits of buying local food and making sure, especially now as we're talking about global supply chains and the cost of goods, right? Like,
right.
How important is it to know that we have farmers down the street who can keep us fed no matter what happens elsewhere?
Absolutely. You know, talking about intimidating and, you know, obviously you can have a membership at a cooperative, but I know it is intimidating if you don't understand what it is and that anybody can walk in and anybody can purchase. Do any of you have a rough guesstimate of how much of your business is actual members and how much is actual non-members?
Yeah, our members have been at 65% of our sales routinely.
That's probably somewhat
interesting.
Common.
I always thought it'd be higher. But
yeah, I think that's actually somewhat common, like somewhere between 50 and 75, depending on the community. And yeah, it's often in this mysterious thing, like, oh my gosh, can I go in there? Everybody's welcome to shop there. It's not like Costco where you have to have a membership to buy something. You actually can buy something at a food co-op without being a member owner.
We've tried to do a lot of social media around this. One area we really specialize to is that we have a big bulk section. And, you know, these days when we're talking about waste and reducing our impact, that's one area where you can come in and buy some goods with zero waste. You can bring your Tupperware, you can weigh it and fill it up. And so we've done some social media about that, showing like, here's how you weigh your thing. Here's how you get the tear weight. Here's how you fill it up. And right. And we've gotten a lot of feedback on that. I think people really appreciate that kind of thing because they're curious, but you just don't know. And it's nice to have somebody kind of guide you through it.
That's
Definitely an effort to get people to realize that they don't need a membership. People are used to a Sam's Club and the stuff, and like, yeah, you know, actually $150 is an equity investment it isn't a fee for the privilege of shopping. I usually do a little shtick like that, but yeah, I just talked to a Lions Club last night and 80% of them were like, oh, I didn't think I could go in.
Exactly.
Membership dues.
I want to see you there.
Right. And that membership dues, at least for us, they're for a lifetime. So you can pay in this amount slowly and you don't have to do it again. You can pay it all at once and you're invested for your life. So, I mean, those are things that are really important communication points that people don't understand that help kind of lower that barrier to thinking that they can't afford it or they aren't welcome. But
how much are your membership fees for all of you?
Ours are 150. Yeah, ours are 152. We just raised those recently to help kind of make this expansion possible. And
sure. Jeannie, is that kind of on par with what you found at Eastside?
Well, I mean, they're all over the place. Like every now and then I come across a co-op who's got like a $10 thing that they came up with in 1971 when they somehow thought that was going to be enough to sustain them. And it's not. But I think now, you know, Willie Street's a huge one in Madison, and I think theirs is still pretty low, like 80. But most of the startups now are at least 150. Some of them are 200. It's just, you know, it takes a lot of capital to get a grocery store off the ground and through these expansions. And so that's probably pretty common, I would say. And usually I was going to say real quick, a lot of times, and this is like sometimes what I'm talking to co-ops about, but, you know, a lot of times they're giving, you know, if, from a purely investment standpoint, if you buy something for $150 and if that co-op is doing, if they're doing patronage or if they're doing member discounts, you know, four times a year, or something, almost always you get your return on that within like a year. And then all the years after that are just gravy. It's like the best investment deal, maybe right. Too good. Sometimes I think people are just, you know, giving out so many discounts, but it is an extraordinary return on that investment. And what it really does is provide needed capital to that business so that it can keep investing in its own future and the community's future.
And just on that point of capital, I mean, something that we did in terms of our real relocation and our capital campaign here last year during the pandemic was routine in a lot of co-ops for expansions is we did what's preferred shares. And so those are, we had a $500 share that existing members could invest or reinvest in their co-op. And it's, again, the point I made during the pandemic that I thought was a good selling point, and it's still an important thing. It's the pandemic brought to light this rub between kind of corporate America and Main Street America and independent businesses and large businesses and small businesses. It kind of just shone a great light on that. And one selling point I had was that, look, do you want to invest in Coca-Cola or do you want to invest $500 in a Main Street business? There's not that many opportunities. I think there's co-ops in terms of capital formation really are this interesting vehicle. And the law supports us to be this interesting vehicle to raise local equity funds that can be invested in a Main Street business. It isn't often that a local hardware store is like, oh yeah, you can invest in us, just sign up over here. It just doesn't work that way. They might go out for a partner at some point when they're making some change, but it's often very hush-hush. Unless you know that family or something, it's not like, even if you wanted to support that hardware store, and you wanted to support that Main Street business, there really isn't this visible opportunity to do so. There's not some ticker tape that runs outside of Main Street where people can just, you walk up and you just start handing money to some broker under the ticker tape and it changes the prices on all the, you know what I'm saying? Yeah. So I think that's really something to be said about co-ops as a vehicle for investment or an opportunity for investment. Because we really do serve our local communities and take a lot of pride in that. And so that's something that really ought to be emphasized.
Absolutely. Gosh, I can't believe we're already at our time. I am inviting you all back for another episode of this because we can go so deep, but I think this will give people something to talk about in our communities because we all know that rural grocery stores have a really difficult time surviving, but especially starting, you know, how do you even do that? And so I think this is a good first episode for us. And I know we can talk even more, you know, I would love to talk more about the nuances and, you know, what some challenges and opportunities are. And gosh, Jennifer, how you go from having a small footprint to all of a sudden having a smoothie bar and a deli. I mean, that's just crazy to me. So I want to invite all of you back, but before we sign off, if you could each just let our listeners know how they can find you online if they want to check you guys out. Jennifer, I'll start with you.
Yeah. So we're at crowingfoodcoop.com.
Awesome. And Jeannie?
You can find Co-Luminate at Co-Luminate. .coop, and you can see me and all of our consultants there who specialize in different areas.
Great. And Ryan?
Yeah, you can learn more about Mana Food Co-op at manafoodcoop.com.
Awesome. Thank you guys so much. This has been an awesome conversation. I could talk with you all day, but, and I mean it, I would love to have you guys all back.
You've been listening to the Center of Everywhere podcast, where we explore stories of rural Minnesotans who are making a difference in their communities. Rural isn't in the middle of nowhere. It is in the center of everywhere.